Welcome to A Baha'i Perspective. I interviewed Maggie Calder on December 26, 2024. Born in Glasgow, Scotland, Maggie grew up in Toronto, Canada when they moved there when she was 7. She was brought up in a motorcycle biker family. At about 12, she realized that she had to look at life in a different way. And at about 15, she left home, becoming a street kid. After a few years, she found out about Eckhart Tolle and realized that this could be someone that could help her spiritually. So she became his assistant and chef. While traveling the world with him, Maggie married and moved to Chicago. It was in Chicago that Maggie found the Baha'i faith, and while involved with the Baha'i community, she created and produced a Baha'i CD called Divine Prayers. While in the throes of a divorce, Maggie went to Thailand for a 10-day holiday, not realizing that it would become a 10-year life experience there. While in Thailand, Maggie meets Master Monk Basakornand and eventually becomes a nun monk in his order, and given the name Metawi. While there, she opened a secret sewing school that gave children who were in the Thai sex trade an alternative trade by sewing products for sale. Her book, to be published in 2025, called Metawi's Secret, describes her spiritual journey in Thailand. I started the interview by asking Maggie where she grew up.
I was born in Scotland, in Glasgow, Scotland. And my family were the people that were on the boat that went to New York, because my great-grandfather was one of the builders of the Empire State Building and brought us from Glasgow to New York. But at that time, they weren't accepting so many people from Scotland and Ireland because there was too many in New York at that time. So we ended up in Toronto, where my grandfather lived. And I grew up mostly in Toronto.
So were you born in Scotland?
Yes.
And so how old were you when you came over to Toronto?
I would say around seven mm-hmm. years old.
Do you remember anything about Scotland?
Yes, I remember that my grandmother had a big down bed, and we would every year unhook the bed and throw all the down around the room and pack the bed back up and make her bed every year. So I remember doing that. And I remember how cold it was, that you would have to go outside to the toilet into the little hut outside. Yeah, I remember a little bit.
Do you remember what your first feelings were about leaving Scotland and arriving at Toronto at 7 years old?
You know, at that young, I was really feeding off my parents' feelings, and they were really excited. They called it the land of the free. So they kept saying, wow, we got our passport stamped to the land of the free. So as a child, the land of the free, what does that mean? I was more curious than fearful.
So as you were growing up in Toronto, what was religious or spiritual life like growing up?
My family, being Scottish and Irish, and coming a bit from the Highlands, if I could say it like that, when they moved to Toronto, they became more focused on the biker lifestyle. So my family were more involved with motorcycles and that lifestyle and that mannerism. You know, there was a lot of parties and music at my, all of us played instruments. So my dad would make his own beer, and my mom would do the food, and all the relatives would come over. And every Saturday, our house was a constant music and food house. But, you know, in the biker way, there's fighting and aggressiveness and things like that. You know, as for a religion, there wasn't really a religion other than the Catholic background and things like that. And I just really, at some point in my life, I think I was around 12, where I went, there's got to be more to life than this. So when I said, like, there's got to be more to life than this, something inside of me just kind of started to see life a little bit differently, that my family pattern wasn't the pattern that I naturally wanted to live, or I felt was the life to live. being a curious person, being a courageous person, it sent me on a little bit of a life journey to discover what that meant.
So what did that journey or turn look like between, let's say, 12 and 20?
12 and 20 was a tough one. Lots of fighting, lots of drugs and alcohol. It was so painful for me, I packed my bags and I left home. So I moved on the streets as a street kid.
At what age?
Around 15.
And so how did you survive?
Well, for me, I knew, coming from a biker background, that to be strong and tough is a protective tool. So I cut my hair like a crazy boy, and I knew how to fight. So I looked for sort of the key person that were, you know, abusive to the young girls on the street, and I beat them up. And in beating him up and cutting his ear off, it made me on the street known as the crazy kid, don't go near her, which ultimately kept me safe. And, you know, when you want to eat and stuff, you eat out of garbages or you steal food in markets or you beg a little bit. But in those days, it was in the 70s, there wasn't begging, you know, not like they have street people today. I mean, you basically had to fend for yourself.
And how long were you in this state of being a street kid?
Well, I think I was about 17. There was a dear friend of mine, Tamir, who has been in my life my whole life now, who invited me to her house for a meal. And she saw in me something I didn't see in myself, but she saw, I would say, more my true nature, my kindness and my sensitivity, which I didn't know at that time. I was still playing the biker role, and the biker role being tough and swearing a lot and being aggressive and stuff, thinking that was my way to protect myself, and it might have been. And then it was in the late 70s, what they call soup kitchens. And I went there, and there was a lady there who invited me to have food and not have to eat out of the garbage, and also offered some free clothing that was more suitable. And over time, they also found places that you could go and get a job. So she actually got me a job in the storage unit of a shoe store. So I packed shoes into, you know, as they delivered them.
When did, let's say, your spiritual search start to blossom, I would call it?
Let's see now. I presume when I got married, I moved to Chicago, where my ex-husband was from. I started to see a different life when I was there, and I started to meet different kinds of people. And one of them was Sue and Tom Gandolf, who would do firesides.
So what's a fireside?
The firesides are Baha'i insightful teachings of the times.
So they were like informal meetings?
Yeah, and just discussions of the times that include all spiritual modalities and insights. And they really started me to feel, to observe this Baha'i understanding. So I studied that. What I loved about it is it included all religions and all peoples, and that really started to open up my awareness spiritually to the infinite possibilities of connecting to things that I didn't even know existed, like God. I didn't quite understand that. I knew of a God, but I didn't believe there was a God. But that started teaching me there's higher powers, there's energy, there's ways we connect to people of cause and effect. And it really started to enrich my life. And then in the process of a divorce that I went through, the pain was a lot emotionally, something new for me. And my friend Tamir again, who was living in Thailand, and she said, why don't you come to Thailand for a holiday and have some time out for massage and good food and just a 10-day joy. Through that process, I trusted her and went to Thailand for 10 days, and it ended up to be 10 years.
Now, before we move on to Thailand, how was it that you ran into these folks and ran into the Baha'is?
Well, my curiosity always, you know, as I said earlier, I knew that there was more to life than just what I was experiencing in that moment. And so I started to research. I started to ask questions to people like, you know, what do you find really happy in your life? And what do you like to do in life? And it started to teach me things that other people did that showed me for me to investigate in them just out of curiosity. I tried different things and different belief systems, and nothing really hit home. Someone introduced me to the Baha'is. What I loved about it was it really allowed to see it from different angles, see life from different ways, and accepting different beliefs and ways of life. And that really intrigued me, and I wanted to investigate more. And then I met someone who traveled a lot, and they said, you know, different parts of the world really live differently. I'm like, different than how we live in the West? And they're like, yes, very different how we live in the West. And I'm like, I've got to investigate this. I don't know how, but I've got to investigate this.
So I understand when you went to Thailand that you eventually became, was it a Buddhist monk?
I became a Buddhist monk. Well, it was a nun monk. So it's more, the nun is the relationship of how women have connection to the Buddha, Dharma.
And so how did that happen?
Not expected. I was visiting for those 10 days. And out of those 10 days, my friend Tamir introduced me to some local people that she was friends with. One of the local ladies and I felt a very good, deep connection. And she said, you know, I have a very profound monk that I think you need to meet. And I feel you have a connection with him. And I did not know what a monk was. I didn't even know what you do. And I'm like, I don't know anything about it. And she said, just come. He will know if you have a connection with him or not. And I'm like, okay. And she took me on this crazy journey that ended up to be a life-changing experience.
What was the turning point that you committed to being a nun in the monastery?
Well, it wasn't my choice again. I sat with the master, and he said to me, in our past lifetime, you were my teacher, and in this lifetime, I'm your teacher. And I didn't know what that meant. And I'm like, oh, okay. And by the end of that 3 hours of being together, he invited me to stay for a month and learn the Buddha Dharma. And I said, okay. And they said, we'll provide you with something to wear that the nuns wear and accommodation. It's in the jungle temple with no electricity, no running water. You have to walk down to the river to pull your water. You eat once a day and you start learning how to be consciously present within.
And I understand while you were doing that practice that you did a great work for, I think it was children.
Oh, so the job of being a nun or training in that way is to observe in non-judgment. So the task of your life is to observe every moment in non-judgment. And if judgment comes up, you have some kind of connection with that judgment. And as an observer, your job is to even observe what that judgment is, what connection you have with it. So for a month, I was observing with non-judgment until I saw a 60-year-old man purchase a 12-year-old girl in the Thai sex trade. And I found huge amounts of judgment arise in me for him, for them, for the trade, for the injustice, for the slavery. It just went on and on. And I thought, wow, I got to figure this out. I'm not being in my practice as a nun. So I went to my temple, to my master, and I said, Master, I need help. I'm having a lot of judgment of this. How do we release this? I want to stay in this practice. And he meditated for a moment, and then he said, out of all the monks in my temple, you're the only one that has an issue with the sex trade. And it seems pretty fiery in you to have a connection or awareness of that. You have some kind of karma with it. Go and find out what that karma is. And I said, Master, I know nothing about the sex trade. I know nothing about this. I don't know. He goes, go and find out what that is. And so a shaved head monk, white, very tall for Thailand, in a white crisp uniform, would go every afternoon, late, early evening, and observe the sex trade.
So what did that observation look like?
And in the observation, it took a year of observing every night, and people who worked in the industry, as well as the purchasers, got really comfortable with me around. At first, it was like, who's this weird white woman, shaved head in a white uniform, sitting here watching us? And after a year, they got very comfortable with me and started to sit at the table with me. And in that, I started being curious. I started asking questions like, why do you purchase a young girl? What is that? And I started to get information that you would never get from the judging place. So what I started to learn was, when you're not in judgment, you can hear what's really going on. So the man that bought the young girls, which triggered me quite intensely, I later found out from him that most of the men like that are quite distorted and ugly, and the world really judges them. He even said to me, I'm a wealthy man, I'm a kind man, but my look is very distorted and ugly. Even people move away from me because of just how I look. Yet these young girls that I purchase can give me some kind of kindness that I would never feel anywhere else. And in that, you don't have to pay for love. Unfortunately, because of only the way that I look, I have to pay for love just to get a sense of my feeling of kindness and love, because I couldn't get it anywhere else. That really changed my perspective. And when I talked to the young girl, why are you in this trade? In those cultures, it's a culture system, first, second, and third class. And she said, I'm a third class person, and being a third class person, I'm not allowed to educate, and I'm not allowed to get a job. And my family are dying from starvation because we can't get any food or money or anything. And this industry allows us. So the family tribes train the children, the hill tribes, the good-looking children, train them that being physical isn't love, but sharing food together is nurturing and love. So when you see someone in the sex trade, the girls will never eat with their buyers because they're just being physical, but they only eat with those that they feel a love connection with. And this also provides money that helps save their families from dying. Hill tribe people have very difficult times back then. I think it's a little different now, but back then they were dying.
What did you ultimately start doing with this knowledge that you gained?
Right. So I started to realize this is one of the oldest trades in the world. You know, there's so many great industries that we've witnessed over COVID has been disappeared. And yet this industry, no matter what has gone in the world, still sticks around. Why? And that was my next question. And what I realized is, in some strange way, for those that aren't being taken care of by the standard world that we all think we all live in, they need help too. And this is an industry that can help them. Now, yes, it's drugs and alcohol, but drugs and alcohol, unfortunately, is in many different places. Look at the bar and restaurant industry. Look, you know, they just have it in a different way. But it's not necessarily what I would call the ethical heart way, the way of living from the heart. And that's my mission in life, is to live from our heart, the kindness of who we are. And so I started to realize, wow, they need something that will give them the right to make an income. And let's find out how I can do that, where they're not slaves, they're not purchased, and it is able for someone of the stature, in their third class stature. And so I started to observe, and I didn't see much coming until one day, being a very tall white, not tall in my country, but tall in Thailand, I had to get my nun monk uniform made at a local seamstress. And the local seamstress, I went and picked up my uniform from her, and it was perfect. Even the little stitches were weaved together so lovely. It fit me like a glove. I said to her with great love and compassion, if I bring you children, would you teach them to sew? And her eyes filled up with tears, saying, I have been praying to Buddha to help my local children. Yes, yes, yes. So, as a curious person that I am, I went to my expat community. So these are the people who live in the culture, who make American dollars, which is a lot of money compared to the Thai currency. And I said to them, I want to open up a sewing school and get kids out of the sex trade and give them a new trade in sewing. I need money to buy sewing machines, fabric, and a building to have all this happen. If you guys give me $10 US a month, it will help me build that and make it happen. And many of them, as generous as they are, said $10 a month, here's 50, here's 100. And in a very short time, I purchased two sewing machines. I rented a beautiful Thai building, and the Thai buildings have an open area in the bottom and kitchen and bedroom is above, and it was perfect. So I would get the kids for a month. They would have their nice little safe place up above with their bedrooms and kitchen, and down below they would learn to sew.
And so how many kids would you teach at a given time?
It varied, so it could be anywhere from 4 to 6 children. And once they got to a certain stage, then I would teach them how to build a booth and go into the local night markets and sell their beautiful sewn product at the night markets. And they started to make more money, and I showed them how to keep track of their money and keep track of their product, of what they were selling. And they were, of course, being in the industry, they're very charming and beautiful. So that I didn't have to teach them much. It was more on just how to sell and be in this industry. And they started to do very, very well. In fact, today, some of the children are, you know, running management in hotels. Some of them are fully educated and they work in other industries. Many of them have stayed in the sewing industry, teaching their brothers and sisters and aunties. And it just keeps growing.
How many kids do you think have gone through your sewing school?
When I was there, probably about 200, and then they teach, so that could be thousands. And today it's just endless now. It just keeps going.
What were the circumstances that had you leave being a nun and coming back to Toronto?
the industry is also aware, like any business, and having so many kids over the 5 years of having them shift out of the sex trade. Now, keep in mind, some kids stayed in the sex trade because they liked the gifts, they liked the acknowledgement, they liked to be looked at. It made them feel good. So it's not, it was their choice. And so some chose to go back and others chose to stay in the sewing industry or educate themselves using that money to do that. But the organizers of that industry was very upset that I just kept doing that. And being a nun monk, it's like, what? You're working with a sex trade? It's kind of like an oxymoron. But that's how spirit works in my teaching. In my teaching, it's like there's infinite possibilities. Don't have the thought of just one way that that's the right or wrong way. There's many, many ways to find doorways of success and opening up of true heart connection. And that's what happened. And they basically limited me from doing more of that gesture. But what I did was sell the sewing school for a dollar to the lady who taught the kids. And being Thai, she can do whatever she wants and no one can argue with her on that. And that's what happened. And because I was a challenge of taking so many kids out of the sex trade, it was suggested by my monk and also the police for my safety. It's better to come back to my country or Canada. And so where my family live is in Canada. So I came back to be with them.
So you were threatened by those who were managing the sex trade?
Yeah. You start creating a riff, and I'm not of their nature. I'm of the nature of meditation and kindness and collaboration. And that was not what they wanted around. So they realized that I was a bit of a threat and made it pretty clear that I needed to stop doing that.
So you came back to Canada, and I understand that you're working on a book that describes the spiritual journey that you described for us today. What can you tell us about this book that you're working on?
Okay, thank you very much. So while I was a monk, the master observes anybody who stays longer than the months of their natural nature, and then they tend to give you a new name, what they call a monk name. And my monk name was called Meitawi. Meitawi means the one who lifts up. So I asked the master, why is he giving me this name? And he said, it's a name that usually princesses get, and it's the name where they lift up their community. And you seem to lift up everybody that you go near. And Meitawi is a fitting name for you. And I knew the sewing school was somewhat of a secret because we didn't want the authorities of the sex trade to know where it was. The book is called Meitawi's Secret. It's in a three-part system. So part one is about how I got to Thailand, totally unexpected, not something I was thinking of. I was in a divorce and I thought that I had to stay in that energy rather than finding a new path to Thailand. So the first part is really about how I got there. And then the second part is how I became a nun monk. So it's a whole series. Many say I write like a visual, as if they're watching a movie. And some people who've been to Thailand goes, wow, you're bringing me right back to Thailand in that part. So the second part is rich with information of the culture and spirituality and how to live from the heart in our busy world. And then the final part is about how I opened the sewing school, why I opened the sewing school, what happened during that, the layers of that, and how that got handed on to a Thai woman to continue the journey. From that, the King of Thailand, as well as my master, gifted me a beautiful 200-year-old Buddha that was sent back to Canada with me to continue blessing my journey. And I continue that in Canada and America, offering workshops and classes of meditation and mindfulness and how we can live our natural self rather than the conditioned self that we've learned. And, you know, they say, you know, for you to be a good teacher, you have to experience it. And so life gave me that experience from coming from a biker family, racing motorcycles and that whole lifestyle, to finding the Buddha culture, to finding spirit in the heart, to finding how powerful it is to live from our natural nature to who we are, and how kind it is to be that way in the world.
So Maggie, what principles of the Baha'i faith do you treasure most, and that impact your perspective in life?
In the culture, I find, even though some might even have hints of judgment, there is a very profound practice there of non-judging. Non-judging of the self, non-judging of others, having acceptance of that. We all have very different little quirky ways of who we are, what we do, and how it is. Some very wealthy, some struggling, some in between, and all are accepted in the loving kindness. And in that, it can open up doors of infinite possibilities. When you're in a group of people of diverse backgrounds and diverse ways, all accepting each other, there's an incredible way of learning life that you might not learn in other ways that can move into judgment.
Well, Maggie, I want to thank you for taking the time for this interview and sharing your life with us. We look forward to your book, Metta's Secret,
yes,
getting published soon.
Yes. I have a company in Chicago who's interested in doing the audiobook first, and they tested me to see about reading it, so I will be reading it. So we're working in the process. My goal for January is to find what avenue will be the first direction. I'm meeting with an editor, so we're in that process with the vision before the year is out. Metta's Secret will be available.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time and inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Maggie Caldor, a woman who transformed her life from the negative environment she grew up in to becoming a spiritually aware person. Her book is called Metta's Secret, that is about her 10-year experience in Thailand. You can find this interview and other interviews on the website of BahaiPerspective.com. And on the YouTube channel of Baha'i Perspective. You can find the podcast on Spotify and iTunes. For information specifically on the Baha'i Faith, you can go to the website baha'i.org, or you can call the number 1-800-22-UNITE. I hope you'll join me next time on a Baha'i Perspective.
From the hidden words of Baha'u'llah. O son of being, love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee. Know this, O servant. Strength. just need,
we just need
to come out of the dark
into the light.
Pray to God. And open our hearts. O Son of Being, love me that I may love.
We all long this wronged one is beyond compare or equal. We have borne it all with the utmost willingness and resignation, so that the souls of men may be edified and the word of God be exalted. My grief exceedeth all the woes to which Jacob gave vent, and all the afflictions of Job are but a part of my sorrows.
We give our lives for the wronged one, the whole
of us. We
Become
Be calm, be strong, be grateful. Be calm, be strong, be grateful. Be calm, be strong, be grateful. And become a lamp. Be calm,
be calm,
be strong,
be strong,
be grateful. Be calm,
be calm,
be strong,
be strong,
be grateful. Be calm,
be calm,
be strong,
be strong,
be grateful. And be calm. And become a lamp full of light, full of light. And become a lamp full of light. And be a lamp full of light, full of light. Be a lamp
become,
of light.
Be strong,
be a lamp
be
of
grateful.
Light.
And be a lamp full of light. Full of light, be a lamp of light.
Be strong,
be a lamp
be
of light. And be a lamp full of light. Full of light, be a lamp of light.
Be strong,
be a lamp
be
of light. And be a lamp full of light. Full of light, be a lamp of light. Be a lamp of light.
And become a lamp. Become a lamp. Full of light.
Full of light.
Full of light. Be calm. Be strong.
Is my healing, oh my God, and remembrance of thee is my remedy. Nearness to thee is my hope. My healing, oh my God, and remembrance of thee is my remedy. Thy mercy to me is my healing and my succor in both this world. my healing.